I've thought it would be interesting and perhaps helpful to, in this year of our bicentennial, to look at this whole thing we call American values, what we call the American Creed. I'll say a little bit more about that later, and what this has to do with the Christian faith, and specific examples of how we behave as citizens, how we behave as Americans, how we behave as Christians. I think that obviously it's a good time, not only because it's bicentennial and we have, you know, our attention given to the American past, but also in the last few years there have been enough, what should I say, incidents and events in American life to make us want to reconsider, you know, what terrible mistakes, like Vietnam would be one example for a discussion on this, so would Watergate, and so would, you know, so many of the other things that I'm sure will come up. And some of these, which I've listed here on this little sheet as an indication of some of the questions that we might discuss. And what I would like to do then is, in these three periods, and I think there's one more towards the end of the week, we have Christmas coming around, sort of to take over for a day or two towards the end of the week, is take some specific examples and topics of where we are in, you know, our national life today so far as the future of the American Creed is concerned, and where we might go. And I would like to make this as much discussion as possible. You were with me last week, and I think that was the best part of the discussion. It wasn't the lecture, it was the discussion. We had some excellent discussions last week, and I would hope that, you know, we can do that again. Because so oftentimes, you know, people come and just get lectured at, and, you know, they go away, and why did I come? And so I would like very much to make a strictly discussion after just opening up a couple of things itself. All right. One resource, which I think is an excellent one, and which is available in the bookstore, is the book here by Earl Brill. Actually, it's a study guide rather than a long text or anything. It's simply called The Future of the American Past, and then it's a study course on American values. And this one you can remember by the cover, it's red, white, and blue. Is in the bookstore under my name, and the other book that I used last week also is there, and I'll be using again probably next week on biography as theology. But this is a very helpful book, and it's one which is openly and freely a study guide, not, as I say, anything more than that. It simply gives certain ideas and then gives certain suggestions as to how these ideas might be utilized in discussion groups such as these. And I thought that this would be a useful sort of thing to become acquainted with here, and then if anybody's interested, it might be a useful thing to use, you know, a little bit back, a little later back home. But he has some remarkably good ideas on this. And throughout, the whole emphasis is on what he means by the future of the American past. That isn't just a clever little title. I'm going to hand these over to I think there's a few more coming. Thanks. But he is really saying, is there anything in our past that will help us in our future? Is there anything we can use from what I have been sort of traditional ideas about what our nation is all about, so that we can find our way through situations probably more satisfactorily than we've done, in about the last 4 or 5 years in this country? And thus, we want to be moving from the past to the present and to the future all at the same time. And if this gets sort of mixed up, that's fine. If we don't want to make it, you know, a traditional sort of stand-up course. And thus, I would like very much to get it, as I say, if I keep saying it, we're going to have a discussion, I better get to it so we don't have to just keep talking about the fact that we are going to have a discussion. Okay. So, given the idea of whether or not there is a future to the American past, I mean, then let's look at specifically today, mission, tomorrow, freedom, and then Thursday on equality as specific problems to be considered for, you know, for our own lives and for the life, you know, of our nation itself. All right, just a couple of things on background with the idea of mission in America, because I think it is so important. It's a good place to start, and it's such a very controversial subject right now also in our national life as to what our mission is. And if you look at the first questions there, you see the thrust of the nature of the debate as to what are our responsibilities and what are our opportunities as a nation which has received such tremendous, you know, resources and has so many advantages. What are our responsibilities to the world, and what should we do once we understand what our responsibilities are? Now, the first theme is a good one, that is of mission, Because from the very beginning in the founding of America, Americans, first the colonial Americans and then others, have had, you know, the very clear idea that there has always been a unique mission to what America should be in the world. We haven't been just one more nation. I always like to use the example, we're not like, you know, people in, let's say, El Salvador. They don't have any sense of mission to the world down in El Salvador. And then I said, then I get comments back from students, you're unfair to El Salvador, or picking on, you know, minorities or something. Well, I didn't pick on El Salvador deliberately. It's just one example as a contrast, because in our country, from the very beginning, we've had the idea that God has led us to this country and given us various opportunities, resources, and all the rest, not simply for a way of earning a living, not simply for a way of, you know, building a new nation, but to carry out God's will. The very first Puritans who came in 1630 had a very clear idea as to what their purpose or their mission was in coming to this country. It wasn't just to get away from religious oppression in England, although that, goodness knows, was serious enough. But they were literally trying to carry out the familiar passage which we know from Matthew 5 here, that is, you are the light of the world, a city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do men light a candle and put it under a basket, but on a candlestick so that it gives light to the whole house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. From the beginning, then, the Puritans had the idea that they were to be, as John Winthrop actually said in 1630, that the Puritan community, actually in Boston, was to be, as he said, a city on a hill. The eyes of all, you know, are watching, and therefore, since all the world is watching what was happening, they should take with utmost seriousness and solemnity everything they did there, because they were convinced they were to show the world what God expected from them now, and therefore they didn't dare fail. This is something that's, you know, so important in America, that's lasted for such a long time, the success, you know, ethic that we have. They didn't dare fail, because to fail was not only a human failure, but that was to admit that God wasn't with you, that God wasn't inspiring and, you know, and leading you, and therefore there was this enormous, you know, dedication to hard work and discipline and suspicion, you know, of idleness the devil has used for idle fingers and so on, because to fail would mean that the idea of a divine mission in this world was, you know, a fraud, or wasn't really God's will after all. So there's been this very serious moral earnestness in, you know, all of American history, that we haven't done all the things we've done simply because it benefits us as a nation, but because it's God's will that we do so. Now, just let me give you a couple of examples of how the idea of mission has lasted right up to the present, and then we can get into some of the discussion of the specific issues here. The idea of a mission of a city on a hill really took hold right from the very beginning with the Puritans and spread, you know, throughout much of America, and then it was greatly enhanced, as we know now, and probably we're getting tired of listening to talk about the Revolution, but just briefly on this, the idea of mission of America was strengthened greatly during the Revolution, because this wasn't, the Revolution wasn't simply to be, you know, another event to get rid of colonial oppressors or all the rest, but as Jefferson said in the Declaration and Tom Paine said in his writings, that it was to be sort of the next step in the plan that God had for, you know, people throughout the world, to be, you know, politically free, to be economically free, and that if the movement for, you know, for independence in America failed here, it would fail all over the world. Tom Paine made this famous statement that unless we protect, you know, freedom here, that it'll be driven out of Europe, it'll be lost in Asia, it'll be lost in Africa. And therefore, the whole burden of proof of what America should be to the world as an expression of God's will rests with the success of the American mission. And therefore, you know, we don't dare fail. And this, I think, shows in the ideas of Jefferson, of Washington. I've often thought myself, if I were George Washington, if I would risk, you know, that magnificent plantation of his at Mount Vernon, you know, for a cause. Because if, you know, if the American Revolution had failed, George Washington would never have seen Mount Vernon again. And I, you know, I'm not sure I would have been convinced of the rightness of this, because what he was committing was treason, no question about that. He was breaking the British Constitution, and the British didn't take kindly to people who, you know, broke the Constitution. They had a big thing they called the Yardarm, which took care of people who were guilty of treason. But the American Revolution did succeed, and of course that gave an enormous amount of confidence to Americans, because here were this small group of colonists, many of whom were very poor, very little education, who were able to defeat, you know, the British Empire. And, you know, the old cliche is true here, nothing succeeds like success. And from that time on, America convinced itself, Americans, that they had a mission, not only to have, you know, political and economic independence and freedom for themselves from Europe, but also to, you know, conquer the wilderness, to move westward, to, if necessary, take the land by force from the Native Americans, to establish their way of life, their social life, their religious life, economic life throughout all of the West, even though, obviously, we didn't, quote, own the land in the West itself. And if the Mexicans got in the way, that was too bad. If the Indians got in the way, that was too bad. But the best, I think the best expression of the idea of American mission comes really with Lincoln in the Civil War, because Lincoln saw the Civil War not just as a struggle between, you know, slave owners and free soil people, not as just two different economic systems, but he saw it as a struggle, just as the Puritans did, to preserve, you know, the will of God on earth. Lincoln himself had been something of an agnostic all through his adult life until he came to the Civil War and there started asking, you know, some pretty important and profound questions. And he finally came up with what we call the last best hope of earth. Much like Tom Paine had said in 1776 that, you know, if America failed, then freedom would fail everywhere. And therefore there could be no expense too great, no price too high to pay for preserving, you know, the experiment in self-government, which we found because they were convinced that this was the will of God, the will of God for the future, and not only for America, but, you know, for all the world, that we should be able to share and expand and spread our values, our way of life, not only to, you know, white Europeans, but also to all people who came under our influence. Well, very briefly then, just two more expressions of American mission. As long as we were dealing just with sort of the North American continent, there really wasn't much resistance to the idea of American mission because we really didn't interfere with too many people, except the American Indians didn't take too kindly. You know, they don't think much of celebrating the bicentennial at all. It's not their thing. And we come from Minneapolis, where AIM, the American Indian Movement, is very strong with Dennis Banks and the Bellacourts and all the rest. And it's, you know, it's pretty lively around there all the time. And so they've taken, you know, a rather negative view of celebrating the bicentennial and of American mission because they've been shoved onto reservations and, you know, treated rather badly there. But to stay with the point, we expanded our sense of mission to the world in World War I. And it was a very devout, dedicated Christian by the name of President Woodrow Wilson, who gave sort of an additional broad meaning to the idea of what America's mission was, to not only to people within, you know, the boundaries of the United States, but to the whole world. And Wilson himself was convinced that it was God's will that we should go to war to preserve the values and ideals of Western civilization. And his idea was, you know, this one war and no more. Make the world safe for democracy. Just as though democracy, you see, was equated then with the will of God. And he was convinced that it was. Why shouldn't it be? Because it gave people political and economic liberation, independence, freedom, all these good things, and therefore, if necessary, even by force, America should be willing to spread its sense of mission to all of the world. And he came up with the idea of peace without victory, the idea of a united, well, it turned out to be a United Nations later, a League of Nations, so that the goal of preventing war once and for all could, you know, could be achieved through this kind of organization. And America believed in the mission of World War I. We believed that this is what God's will really was for us. And there was, with the exception of a few people like the Irish Americans, very little resistance to going into World War I, that we believed that this had been God's will for us. And Wilson cast the whole thing in a very sort of religious crusading term, the Great Crusade, as you remember the George M. Cohen songs with us over there and all the rest that go along with this as an expression for this. And of course the idea of mission was greatly extended in World War II. There wasn't any controversy at all about America's participation there because it seemed as though we had been unfairly and unduly and immorally attacked by the Axis powers. And therefore the sense that America had a special mission to the world, that because of our resources, our strength, our population, all the rest, we were the preservers of freedom for the world, was greatly strengthened in the war itself. And then, of course, came all the agonizing things with the Cold War, with Korea, and for the first time there, you know, America, and this is where I want to stop and then start the discussion, America didn't win. That was a problem. Every time before, we'd gotten into a major controversy or a major war, starting with a revolution, we had won. And if we didn't win, like in the war with Mexico, we said we won anyway. which is a nice way of doing things. I always like what Senator Aiken said. You remember when in Vietnam, that when we didn't know what to do about it, Aiken said, "Well, why don't we just declare that we won and then go home?" He was a pretty salty old character. He'd been around for a long time in Washington, and I kind of like that just go in and say that because nobody's ever going to be around to dispute you with us. But America was used to winning because we always claimed, you know, that God was on our side. And therefore, with the war with Mexico and with the war with Spain in 1898, we believed that if God hadn't wanted us to win these wars, we wouldn't have won them. And therefore, we must be doing God's will, because everything came so easy, and everything came, you know, so clearly, you know, in our favor. And hence, we were testing ourselves, you see, against what we thought God's will was for us. And since we kept winning, then that must mean that obviously God is smiling on us and encouraging us. But then comes Korea, where everything sort of ended, you know, in a terrible stalemate, and no clear victory there, and a lot of, you know, frustration and agonizing and soul-searching. What went wrong with America? They were finding there were, you know, communists writing Methodist Sunday school curriculum. That was one thing that was wrong, that they found. They really, you know, really said that, that there were, you know, communists, reds under every bed, and finding all kinds of scapegoats for what was obviously, you know, an entirely different kind of situation. And the idea of mission was, you know, somewhat subdued, because it seemed as though the concept of right and wrong as to what America's mission should be in the world was greatly diminished because we didn't win in Korea. And thus it was much less clear to the population and to our leaders, specifically what our mission should be. And then, of course, I want to end with the Vietnam War, because I think the problem there was we were using the old categories of, you know, absolute right and absolute wrong, good guys, bad guys. America can't do anything wrong because we've always done the right thing, because otherwise why would we be such a great and powerful and strong nation? And when we took that into a whole different kind of, you know, situation, a civil war in a, you know, such a distant part of the world, and things didn't, you know, immediately work out to our advantage, we didn't know where, you know, to turn or who was to blame. And it wasn't, well, I could go into that in great detail. And hence, I think what's happened to us now, and this is where I'd like to stop and then raise points for discussion, is that it's no longer as clear as it was, you know, even 20, 30 years ago, what, you know, America's mission in the world should be, what really should be our responsibilities to ourselves, to others. Should we have opened up, you know, our doors, for instance, to all the refugees from South Vietnam? Doesn't this mean taking away jobs, for instance, from some, you know, native-born Americans? We have three Vietnamese families in Northfield, for instance. The Lutheran pastors, the whole Lutheran Congregations Association, brought in three families. And they're going to get a job somewhere, and that's going to mean somebody else isn't going to get a job. And therefore, you know, some people have been wondering about that. So I think Vietnam has helped us, you know, has brought us to the point where we should reconsider our mission and whether or not we have, you know, the kinds of responsibilities that once to the rest of the world and to ourselves that were once so clear. For instance, just one last thing, President McKinley had no doubt in his mind at all in 1898 that the United States should conquer the Philippine Islands. He had prayed about it, and I'm not questioning his sincerity. If the only interesting thing is that every time, you know, a national leader said he prayed about it, it always came back, the answer always came back, you know, go ahead, get a green light, you know, for this. Maybe I'm just being a little bit too cynical, you know, in our day and age, because most people at that time, you know, definitely supported him with this. So with that idea of mission in mind, let me just finish up with a statement here that Brill makes on this idea of mission in America. Because he's arguing that there is, you know, a very clear division in our country over what our mission should be. So many people want to continue, a lot of people want to continue with very active leadership in the world and feel that that's our responsibility. And other people believe something like this, and I'll just quote you very briefly on this. And sort of the anti-mission people say this: "We have no right to impose our way of life on other people. We have no mission in the world. We should have none. Instead of trying to spread American power and influence over all the world, we should devote ourselves to dealing with our own problems. We should end poverty, racism, exploitation, and injustice at home. We should clean up our environment and rebuild our cities. We should build a good society right here in America. That will provide a better example for the rest of the world than trying to convert it to our way of thinking." So is, you know, in sort of cyclical terms, what we have here is a reaction to much of the global adventures in which we found ourselves, you know, involved ever since, really, ever since war with Spain in 1898. So, in keeping with the idea that America is to be, you know, how should I say this, judged as a nation which seeks to do God's will. In fact, President Kennedy's inaugural speech closed with the phrase, God's work must be our own, which is taking on a pretty big responsibility. Should we, you know, have we reached a point where, put it that way, that it's time to reconsider whether or not we should, you know, continue with the enormous responsibilities that we've taken up for ourselves, and should we build a good society at home first before, you know, before we try to preserve the others, other countries? Let's look specifically at these 12 that I've got here and see if that will start something, and then we can go from the specific. Oh, didn't I get, there's still some more to go around? Okay, you want to hand out some more? Okay. And we'll go from the general, from the specific to the general, and see if we can decide towards the end here what, you know, America's mission should really be. Okay, now, don't worry about my typing. I learned how to type on a stencil, but I didn't learn how to correct it. And somebody just gave me a little bottle of some fluid, and I didn't know what to do with that, so I just decided to strike over and launch off anyway. Most of America's interventions in world affairs have been based on enlightened self-interest. Any negative response to that? Should each country do what's best for itself? Is that the way?
No, no. Not necessarily, because we all have to live together in the world anyway. Ultimately,
Yeah. Well, you know, the old idea was that if everybody followed their own self-interest, there would be sort of a harmony of interests, you know, harmony that would, you know, old Adam Smith's idea, that would take place. Yeah.
Well, I think it's just the opposite. If everybody, kind of like people, everybody does exactly what they want to do, a lot more people are going to be hurt than helped. So when people get together and give up some of their self-interest and work together, then you have harmony. It's like now the United Nations is practically falling apart over Israel and Egypt, because here you have two highly polarized things coming together in a clash, and there's just nobody's going to give anything anyway, and this could really destroy the United Nations. And I don't think the United States has ever been too enlightened in its self-interest. It was out and out to get what it could, just like the rest of them.
Why is it so hard to give up self-interest, you know, for a nation? As individuals, it isn't so hard. But why nations? You know, everybody knows that a third world war would be a disaster. Everybody thought a second world war, that's what, you know, would be a disaster. In fact, that was Wilson's whole premise with his idea that war was unthinkable. And therefore, he assumed, you know, too much goodwill. The Southern Presbyterian, he shouldn't have. He should have known a little bit more about original, what we would call original sin, or I guess Lutherans would call the old Adam, isn't it, from the old catechism. And yet he assumed that there would, war was unthinkable, and that therefore, you know, he proceeded ahead on goodwill. But why, but, you know, even knowing, you know, the disasters of, you know, atomic warfare, or nuclear warfare, I should say, and all these things, yet you hear saber rattling or sword rattling and, you know, all these things going on anyway. I mean,
It's the difference. People like, everybody likes to think somehow, you know, even as we as individuals are all different in this room, but in our contact with each other, we're willing, you know, to give and take. But when it gets down to nations, the bigger they are and the more powerful they are, it seems that, you know, our motivations and everything is aimed at self-preservation. In a day and age like this, where the whole world is practically run by military, and this, of course, military lives in continual fear of somehow, you know, not having enough or being beaten. So here you have this whole thing emphasized, you know, much more so than normally.
Is it that we're so close to what, you know, global genocide, I suppose?
Yeah, well, see, that's it. And yet, here, how many we've got, I don't know how many, we've got enough atom bombs now and you know, stuff around here that we could
15 times we could destroy
the whole world out 100 times.
But
our military is risen tremendous fear that the Russians got get five more than we've got, You know, something disastrous is going to happen. And the Russian military feels the same way. If the United States has, say, six more, you know, something that can wipe out the world in one smack, well, they've got to have six more. See, and this is, you know, it's really kind of like...
Yeah, I want to come to number six here in a little while on the military thing, but do you think, you know, keeping with what we've talked about already, do you think it's... I mean, some of this polarization is due to the fact that Americans have this sense of mission?
I think we've got a strong, tremendous drive. Each individual has been born with that. No one likes to be wrong. And I think that, as you have stated, that success has been eminent in the history of America. We feel you know, that we know what we're doing, and that anyone else should follow our example, period.
Okay, and then I want to come back to you.
I find in my own mind a lot of confusion of where I really stand. I was in the middle 30s, I was in high school, and had very high ideals. You know, I think this is true of any generation. The new generation is very idealistic. And then right away, as soon as I get out of high school, I bump right into World War II. And I believed in that, that we had an enemy in Hitler, that it was very justified on many reasons that we rid the world of this kind of a power. Okay, then we come to the Korean situation, and still look clear for our mission as a democratic country, and still Vietnam, I felt something like my country, right or wrong, I would support it, you know. Now, work-wise, I work for McDonnell Douglas, who has representatives in just about every country on the globe. And our planes are flying literally in every country except Russia. And we are a company that have given a balance of foreign trade dollars, you know, tipped it very much. We export. But then I get this feeling that the United States, you know, like in going into Vietnam, expended its treasures, its reserves that it could have, I don't know, and I don't believe that we have come to the belief, I used to believe that, well, we had something to give to the world, and democracy, and we were a favored country under God. And in light of the events in the last 30 years, I'm confused now what our mission is. Our democracy that we had worked because we were already a democratic English colonist. We had a jury system that was that came over with the colonists, and they had somewhat of a they had constitutional law. But this doesn't always say that this works in Mexico or Zaire or where have you, that they aren't, there has to be the tradition of this kind of a thing before it works in these countries. So I have this emotion that, or feeling that our way of government doesn't necessarily be the one that we should impose upon them. And then the other thing, I have, last week, I've been here a week, and one of the speakers, we had a series on where we're going to be economically in the late 20th century, and where we might be in the 21st. And it's utterly shattering to see a report like the second report to the Club of Rome, which I've been reading at nights a little bit, to see all of these things have been put into computers, and that the effect that our industrial, and we've made a remarkable thing in our industrial revolution. It had started other places, but the United States brought it to the peak. And then I think after World War II, things were going along in somewhat of a curve like this, and all of a sudden, we just take off on right angles. There was a revolution in everything, communications and economy and travel. We go to the moon, you know. And so, I don't know, my feelings are, I don't know where I stand anymore.
You think it's because things have, the world we live in is changing so rapidly that, you know, the old American past doesn't have much of a future?
Well, I think today I have more of a world community feeling, whereas before I didn't have that, and I don't know, it's hard for me to sift out these things.
Okay.
Well, I think today I have more of a world community feeling, whereas before I didn't have that. And I don't know, it's hard for me to sift out these things.
Okay.
Well, I think part of what helped this whole idea of the American mission, kept it going, is that even when we started out, we were not just English in this country. There were Scots, and there were Germans here, and there were Dutch. These people melded together, and they formed an ongoing nation. Then there were the great emigrations from Europe, primarily Northern Europe, the Germans and the Scandinavians, the Irish, they came over, and they blended in. And as they blended in, they could see, coming from poverty-stricken countries, like my great-grandparents came over, they were busted flat, you know. Got out of Germany to get away from Bismarck and get drafted. But they got in, they settled on a little farm, they made things better for their children. And this has been the great American dream,
right?
Making things better for your children. And my grandparents made it better for their children. Their children made it better for me. And as they see these things working, you absorb your American heritage, because the German heritage went on in my family about my grandparents. That was gone. We were Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know during World War I, my grandparents, everybody was afraid of them because they were Germans.
Yeah.
And they had a horrible time. Even Roosevelt in World War II took the 32nd Division, which is Wisconsin Division, primarily German, and shipped them off to Australia.
Right.
He was still afraid.
Yeah.
But see, by this time, these people have been so absorbed into this. I'm not speaking just German, Paul. I mean, your Northern Europeans had it real easy. They just came over. And all they had to do was change their language, and they melded in. They became part of the American dream, and this whole American mission. The Southern Europeans, your Italians and Spanish, had a much rougher time than your Slavic people. But and I think this thing kind of kept going, and I still think there is this feeling that we do somehow have something to give, and it kind of grew into the, well, why don't they be like us, you know?
Yeah.
You get that kind of feeling, you know, like in India, well, they're starving. Well, why aren't they like us? Why don't they develop farming methods and that so they can produce more and more grain to feed their people? And I think we got a little bit superior along the line that we couldn't be beaten.
Yeah,
like you were speaking there, you know, this is kind of a, what do they call that? A cultural shock when you get beat the first time. You know, I think we've had a few of them in the last 20 years that really banged us.
Right, so the mission thing really then is a very tenuous thing, because on the one hand, you want to believe that what you're doing, you know, is the will of God, and on the other hand, how easy that can slip into self-righteousness.
Or it can go the other way, too. One failure and
right, that you can give up with this. And, you know, it's very difficult for nations to live in this kind of balance between, you know, really, and I'm convinced, you know, that people like Wilson were certainly sincere, trying to really do God's will on earth. And how do you do this without, you know, becoming judgmental?
Well, that's it. It's keeping the... It almost depends upon total success. You can never fail, because this whole American mission came on, like you were telling, on unending strings of success, even if we had to declare they were successes.
Yeah, right. From an economic standpoint, you know, the wilderness and then building it up to, you know, the huge thing, and how that's reversed now, too, because technology isn't, you know, an unmixed blessing anymore, and how that's, you know, reversed itself. Because before, you know, you and I were talking last night, you know, the great idea was to get an industry into a community. That was a big goal, and now that's even backfired, that it's costing a community more sometimes when it gets an industry in, because, you know, everything that seems to be good is, you know, is turning out to be bad. Les, you had...
Yeah, just picking up on this heritage thing, I think that for many years we have practiced the survival ethic, the idea that we have to have technology to survive, and the wilderness conquering and so forth, and... along with that, you know, other nations call on us for help, and so we went over to try and help them. Of course, there you get the superiority complex. And I think that that the big turn has come in the change from the survival ethic to the self-identity ethic, the idea that kids today are asking the question, you know, not how can I survive? We've told them how to survive. Mm-hmm. They're not concerned about that, but who am I? And who am I? Is a different kind of mission. It's a mission to self, a mission to awareness, not a mission to go and do something necessarily. And I think that is an act of God, that that He is alerting us to the fact that that we are not simply the successful people who go around helping everybody else, but we got to find out who we are too.
I think that's right. That's taking place in the country, and that's why, you know, you and I and the rest are confused, because many of the old foundations, you know, are gone, and we find, for instance, in some countries, the things that we've been through, you know, haven't been solved, you know, by other countries. For instance, one of the most agonizing problems, of course, is Northern Ireland, you know, and you know, you hear, for instance, some of the things, the dialogue there. And the criticisms, for instance, of the Pope are things we were saying like 150 years ago in this country. And yet that's taken, you know, just as gospel virtually there. And how frustrating it is, because of the agony and the death and everything, the destruction that's taking place. And how disastrous that kind of nationalism can become when you get religion involved in it. And I think, you know, this is a very tricky thing, because you can use religion both as a source of, you know, justification, you know, God's on my side. I remember that from World War II. I remember Joe Lewis saying that once. Shouldn't pick on Joe Lewis. He was just a victim, you know, of the market, I guess, who wanted people like that. But or whether or not, you know, we're in any sense on God's side, trying to do, or I should say, God's will, and the whole self-righteous thing has become, you know, disastrous in the world. And I think the rest of the world has come to resent much of, you know, the American sense of mission, because they argue, who appointed, you know, you? What if, you know, like, for instance, let's say the communists in either Russia or China, their argument is, why should your sense of mission be normative or directive, you know, for us? Why, you know, why, if you want to do your thing, fine, why don't you let us do ours in our particular area? And in America, that's awfully hard to accept. You know, the idea that we're going to have coexistence. And maybe some of you heard Solzhenitsyn just a couple of weeks ago. He sounded like an old Cold War warrior. He said, no more trade with Russia, cut off all, you know, communications. And, you know, the guy's been through an enormous amount himself, and you can't just dismiss him as a nut, because he suffered personally so much and has seen so much death and destruction and all the rest. But I think the mission thing is very difficult for Americans to overcome, because it's been our sense of identity, as Les was talking about, and now, you know, it's gone. And the old red, white, and blue oratory, I think, is pretty well shelved for a long time. And I don't know what, you know, it's just like with the Peace Corps. Everybody was so excited about the Peace Corps, and all of a sudden, you know, where is it? It's virtually, you know, vanished with the cynicism on this. I'm not so sure that, you know, for the time being at least, there's going to be any clear, you know, sense of where we can go with this sort of thing. Now, another thing, though, that's tricky, and it came up here before, and I wanted to bring this in with number six with the idea of mission, is that as the pendulum has swung the other way against, you know, our American involvement and against American participation and doing things like helping, you know, the refugees and all the rest, that we can become total cynics on the other hand and believe, as they did, some of you will hear, will remember, right after World War I, when we were looking for what went wrong, we blamed everything on the munitions makers. You remember the Nye Committee? Senator von Nye from Montana had a big witch hunt. And then once we could identify those munitions makers, they were the real devils. And we'd clean them out, and boy, we won't get in any more, you know, trouble like we did with World War I. So they're looking for devils, and they found out in munitions makers with this. And the old, you know, munitions makers plot has appeared again, I think, in America, with the idea that everything's being run by the military. Or maybe it is. When we have, what is it, 80-some billion dollars in our military, in our defense budget now, over half of the whole budget is under the direction of Secretary Schlesinger. Is it that we need, like the idea we have, you know, enough atomic bombs to kill every communist 15 times, I guess it is, that's the last count anyway, that we don't dare cut back and use those resources for rebuilding the cities and cleaning up the environment and all the rest, because the economy would, you know, collapse? Are we in a perpetual, you know, what should I say, this wartime economy out of necessity, simply to maintain employment and, you know, for everybody, it'll be disastrous? And if so, aren't we really then under the influence of, you know, the so-called military-industrial complex?
Well, one of the things that sort of troubles me currently is America is a huge producer and salesman for armor in the world. And then you also have France and England and Sweden. There's a huge arms market. And we will arm both sides, you know, even in the Middle East. We're selling our military weapons and weapon systems, South America. Everybody has to, we convince them, well, you got to have new fighter planes, you got to have some tanks, you got to have this and that. And it's a sort of prestige item with a lot of these small countries that they have armor. But we're the big pusher of our sales ourselves, you know.
Yeah. Again, though, does this rest on the private concerns more than the government?
Pardon?
A lot of the sales could be taking place, I think, if I'm not mistaken, between, for instance, Boeing and some of these communities, states, countries.
Well, the sale of all of our weapons, like I work for Douglas, and right now I'm working on the Skyhawk, and we're selling this to Kuwaiti. 36 planes.
Where is Kuwait?
Kuwaiti?
Kuwait. Maybe you're just pronouncing it a different
Kuwait.
Way.
Kuwait.
Oh, right, fine. K-U-W-A-T. Okay, fine. I thought there was a new country that appeared and I didn't know about it. They come and go now in a hurry.
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
It is our government that sells these now. Like McDonnell Douglas doesn't sell these at all. When we sell our arms, in this particular case, it's the Navy and the government that says, all right, we will sell you or sell Israel or whoever. And then the company representatives step in and provide the technical and delivery and pricing on it. But it's always the government that is selling the arms there. Well, you've got to examine that question.
Yeah, very much. And, you know,
is the theory behind this, then, the balance of arms is going to...
Okay. I think so.
Well, I think the whole... Here again, we're getting back to the military, and not just our military.
No.
But you take little Kuwait or Zaire, Africa, now, all the nations in the world right now, all even these little dinky little things, you know, are spending so much of their budget on military armor, you know, all this military stuff, which is doing them absolutely no good. You know, what good is it if Zambia has two, you know, fighter planes and Zaire has one, so Zaire has to go out, it's broke already, you know, people are starving, goes out and buys two more, so it has three, and the whole thing, you know, it's this saber-rattling showcase sort of thing, and of course, as long as you've got people like the United States and France and England and even Russia who are perfectly willing to sell these things to them, well, then they're going to keep buying, and yet they're breaking themselves by doing this.
Another thing I see that that we sell, and this is other countries besides, all of these emerging African countries have to have an airline, or it's a prestige thing. They fly the flagship of Zaire, and it's a DC-10. They all seem to have a very leading Hilton hotel, air conditioned, and to identify with this new technology. And like you were saying, there are poor people that need fertilizer and to develop their food supply, but the thing is they want to go to these marks of the technology.
This is the great American success. They're trying to adopt our successes to themselves, the third world, so many of them, because this is something you can see. You know, you can say, here, look at this beautiful hotel we have, or look at our nice modern airport, just like the United States. We are still, from an economic viewpoint, the one looked upon. Well, we are as the most powerful in the world. So many of these small countries look to us, and this, I guess you might call it the new American mission, unspoken, you know, but to get everybody to be like us, whether they want to or not, and let them do it all by themselves. They psych themselves into it.
Yeah, I'm wondering, you know, when you're saying these things, if it isn't really the real bugaboo, really isn't the whole sense of mission itself, that every nation has, you know, decided that its own self-interest comes, you know, above all else, and the first, you know, law of survival is out of protection. And if that means military protection and, you know, and all the poverty that comes with us, fine. And I'm just wondering how you break that down, how, you know, nations can learn to, you know, to assume or accept goodwill, and then of course this leads us right into religion, because the whole thing in the Middle East is as much a religious struggle between Muslims and Jews as it is anything else, and how far, you know, we've become polarized because we aren't willing to yield on, you know, on the idea that the Jews have a right to their homeland, and therefore then they become aggressive when they see they're being threatened by the Muslims, and hence is it, you know, in a very real sense you could argue, and it's true with America too, I think in Vietnam, it's this kind of religious, you know, thrust to our sense of mission that has gotten us in all the difficulty. I think we'd be better off if we were, you know, a quote, you know, secular nation. Maybe we should just give up the idea of being under God. And just become like Bismarck. Somebody mentioned Bismarck. Bismarck didn't have any sense of being under God or anything. It was just blood and iron.
Blood and guts.
A statement just recently that the United States is not a God-fearing nation. I believe that 40, it's less than 50% are God-fearing people.
I guess 45% go to church on Sunday.
But if we wrote a new Declaration of Independence, would we be able to leave God out? You think
so? I think that it would be.
I think it's part of the image that we've created.
This image is dying, though. I think here again, this is the old 19, 20, 30, 40 image yet, kind of the pre-Korean thing. Where you won them all, then we were under God. See, but now we don't win them all anymore. So we're getting more into what I call a world reality. We are not way at the top of the world community anymore. You know, standing there God-like or Christ-like, you know, and laying nice blessings on the rest of the world. We are being brought down with the rest of the world. I think under God would be, I wouldn't object if they left it out, you know.
I wonder whether we're moving toward a secular religion, godless society, which is, religion is secular. A couple of years ago, there was quite a bit of writing on this, Robinson, England,
oh, yeah.
And No, like the reaction, and I'm in the Los Angeles area. I come up here and say, oh, you're going to a religious place, you know, quote, it sort of has a freaky, you're one of those religious freaks, you know.
Well, I think actually religion, we'll see a growth of it. We've developed this tremendous technology, and we're finding out it isn't working as great as we thought it was. We really feel that this thing, you know, it's more of a headache than it is. And I think, I mean, we're not seeing it right now so much in Christian religion, but there are an awful lot of, in the United States, in Zen Buddhism, you know, some of these Eastern religions, and interest in mysticism and this, and that people are beginning to realize, you know, that the technology can't take, a computer doesn't understand the human soul, because there's no way you can feed a human soul into a computer.
I'd like to think that, but yet, you know, President Ford knew he could get by with vetoing the strip mining bill, because more people believed in the rights of business to do what they want to do than believed in protecting the environment.
But that's shifting too.
I hope so.
It's kind of like Medicare. I remember
way
back when Truman was for Medicare, Medicaid, and he almost got it. They thought he'd lose the election on that alone. And then all through the 60s, I think in 62, all of a sudden it got passed. Now he wouldn't be without it.
I hope. Right.
See, and I kind of have a feeling this is going to happen.
Could yes.
Don't you think that a lot of this comes down to your first statement there, self-interest? We've got it right here in the United States.
To boost the economy,
yeah. That and a lot of people would say, what's wrong with that? That we have a right to protect ourselves. We have tariffs against, you know, Japanese goods, and if we didn't, you know, we would simply become, you know, reduced to, you know, their level of standard of living and all the rest, and therefore we have, you know, a right to do so.
When they sell something, do we sell it? Is that quotation marks, or do we give it?
We sell.
Do we get back? I mean, what kind of a return is there on it? Or are we just simply going out and indirectly without knowing what we're doing? I mean, what do we get in return for all these things that we're sending to these countries? Is it to protect ourselves, and supposedly, or is it to help? Is it a gift, or
most of us for military aid,
isn't it? Yeah. Well, a lot of it has been so that the nations can become self-sufficient, and that means that they won't become dependent on the communists.
But then we have some of that in our own country. Now, for instance, I read this a short time ago. I don't think we who live here in this type of economy are aware of what's going on. There was a question. Some young fellow, we just out of high school, I think it was, and they asked him, he was looking for a job, and they asked him, can you type? He said, no. So then they sent him over to get $90 a week unemployment thing. It never worked. Now, you see, there's too much of that going on. In fact, the government, if you're not working for the government now, you just aren't in, directly or indirectly. And so you see, all of you all that we're not, if we had a bigger production, if people were producing, instead of there's so many people who either in a very, very high position are getting very, very high income, and those who are more, could we say, welfare or social security, of course they are in different ways. But if there wasn't, if people were producing, and then we wouldn't have the inflation, because there was enough produced, there just wouldn't be that that demand for it, over demand, while others are any number of people who are simply just on the government.
You'll never get away from that anymore. Something like 20% of the people of this nation are actually directly engaged in production. We become a nation of services. People are selling not a thing or making a thing, but they are either shoveling papers around from here and there and yonder, or they are repairing something. The whole thing has become a service thing, which is non-productive. And I think this is cause of much of our problems, that people do like to use their hands and, you know, make things. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got all sorts of things going on here this afternoon where people will just go and make things. They may be very important businessmen.
Isn't the idea there to come to sort of a sense of, you know, what I'm getting at here with American values, that work in itself is always good, and we don't know what to do in an economy of abundance, because what do you do when you overproduce? Because we've always been taught that it's God's will that we should work hard and, you know, thrift and self-discipline and self-denial and all these things. And suddenly now we've conquered all kinds of technological problems, and we can easily overproduce. So what do we do with leisure time? I feel guilty myself with leisure time. Because I've always been brought up, you know, hard work and, you know, this sort of thing. So a lot of people are caught, you know, in a situation where they only have to work, you know, half as many hours now as they did before, and they have all more leisure time. And we've got another kind of problem there with leisure time because we don't know what to do with it. And this increases, well, drinking, for instance, and gambling, and a lot of, you know, what we would call undesirable social behavior.
There's also guilt involved here. You're brought up to work hard, and you, all of a sudden, you know, you get 3 and 4 day weekends. And this kind of gives you, you know, people, you're supposed to be in there pushing all the time with nose to the grindstone. This is success because success breeds more money. And
right.
When you have more money, you're more successful.
Right.
It's the ladder climbing thing.
Right.
A lot of people are just having trouble with that. Many who are retiring now, especially, work real hard all their lives, you know, put 8 hours a day, you know, started on maybe 8 hours a day, 7 days a week, you know, and all of a sudden they retired, nothing there, you know.
And that goes back to the idea of God expects us to produce and to, you know, turn 2 talents into 4 and 5 talents into 10. Like the Puritans, they were hung up on the fact that they, you know, they didn't dare fail.
Work is a way of praising God.
Yeah.
And the harder you work, the more you praise God.
And again, you know, we're caught, you know, like with the mission idea, we're caught because now mission doesn't work anymore, at least the old Woodrow Wilson idea of mission doesn't work anymore. And now hard work can actually create more problems, you know, than it solves, because you can overproduce. And you have too many inventories, and so it's too big an inventory, so you have to lay off. So what do you do? Yeah. Oh, okay, Wes?
Yeah, you read the other parables, like the seed growing soundly.
Yeah, okay.
But what I see here is a kind of a collision between this work ethic of production and of achievement as we see the emptiness of technology today, and as we see the mood changing from conquest and mission to self-identity.
Yeah.
Okay. In the meanwhile, what's happening with the other parts of the world? I see myself, you know, saying, okay, so gas is another 8 cents a gallon more than it was 2 years ago. So let's go to Holden anyway, and let's go to the Midwest, or let's take this trip. And I hear travel agents say, people are still traveling, there's no crisis. And meanwhile, the have-nots, in whom I believe the power of the future rests, in Africa and the third world, what's going to happen? Ultimately, in order for the world to survive, it seems to me, from what I read, that America's going to have to lower its standard of living.
Huh.
And I don't think anybody in this room or in this country is going to do that unless we are conquered from outside. And I don't know, I'd like to know, you know, as a historian,
yeah,
you know, what you see in the future.
Well, I like to deal with the past, that's a cop-out, but anyway. No, really, seriously, you're absolutely right, and it won't be, you know, we have to reduce our standard of living, and it won't come voluntarily. And how difficult that is for Americans, because we blame everything on government now, and the only, you know, agency that can coerce us,
right,
is government. And we don't want to give more power, quite rightly so, to the government.
Right.
In fact, President Ford is running now on an anti-government, get the government off your back ticket, and it looks very big for 76. And I see, interestingly enough, the Democrats are picking it up. Governor Brown seems to be coming in on a get the government off your back ticket, and I see already they're starting to talk about Brown as a dark horse for 76, because the old traditional war horses, like my friend from Minnesota, Hubert Horatio, you know, it's pretty much identified with bigger and, you know, more government. And I think that's true. With the whole idea of mission, that if we're going to cut back and preserve and conserve, I should say conserve what we've got, it's going to have to come with some pretty strong action. Now, Carol was saying that he bought an apartment in Seattle, and he's going to take, you know, the bus because he won't be able to afford gasoline any longer.
Yeah.
And, you know, Southern California, well, last summer, you remember what it was, you know, everywhere and lining up. I'm sure many of you, you know, learned some new expletives, you know, when standing and waiting in line, and, you know, for gasoline. But it's a very real crisis that our American past hasn't really prepared us for, to come, you know, to your answer. And it's frightening to think of the implications of what might be done, because we don't want the kind of welfare state, for instance, in Sweden, they have, where all the government services are very, you know, very good in terms of, you know, all these things, but it's a kind of a stifling thing. What is it? 50% of the of your income is in taxes, and it's sort of, you know, what do they call it? I'm trying to think of this expression where you don't know you're being choked to death because it's such a pleasant experience when it's happening.
You don't know.
Yeah, the American dream for the world is a nightmare.
Yeah?
Absolutely a nightmare. Jim Berquist was telling our convention in Southern California that if, for instance, if they had as many cars in India in relation to the population, they would use up all the metal and iron ore in about 6 years and all the gasoline in 4 years that there would be. And he also pointed out that if we were to reduce our standard of living by 20%, we would live by the French, like the French do.
Yeah.
That is not an answer. See, we'd still go to our Rivieras, they still drive Citroens,
right.
They still have wine with their dinner, they still, you know,
right.
That's 20% less than what we have here.
Yeah.
It's very, it's really scary. I mean,
but you see, we are, you know, we're trapped because we always have said we're doing God's will, and God is showering off His, you know, showering His blessings on us. This is the old Puritan idea: work hard, and God will reward you, as a sign that you're doing God's will. And it's kind of hard to, you know, to give that up. Very hard, yeah.
That's the thing too, not being worried about the third world. I don't really think they're too much worried anymore. It's kind of like it's the big argument between the haves and the have-nots, and we are the haves now. And there for a long time, everybody's really afraid of Russia, but fear communism is dying out because Russia has made the switch from a have-not nation to a have-nation, and they're being really, by some of their poor allies, they're really being given the old razzmatazz too, because their allies are turning against them, and I think, you know, there's a great fear of China trying to run the whole world. Of course, now China, again, they're getting in, they're very industrious people. They're going to swing themselves over to the have side. And once you'll find that the United States and Russia and China and Western Europe and Japan, possibly, we're going to be lined up against the rest of the world.
I think it's going to be against the Arabs, for one thing, because they know they've got us with petroleum.
Yeah, well, I think something will happen there, an accident.
And what will happen, but, yeah, what I understand is that the Arabs have decided that the West has had too much wealth and they're going to, with the petroleum, they can redistribute.